WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Doctors are facing new and confounding ethical questions dealing with life support systems, doctor-assisted suicide, the genetics revolution, and the business ethics of managed care. Doctors and medical ethicists recently gathered at a conference about the AMA's Code of Ethics, which was first drafted 150 years ago. The conference asked how the code needs to be updated to address contemporary ethical dilemmas. My guests are two of the conference's organizers. Art Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Robert Baker is a visiting scholar at the center and teaches the history of medicine at Union College in Schenectady. Art Kaplan says the code still has relevance today.
As I read the old code, it clearly was written at a time of moral confusion in medicine 150 years ago. Different problems. I think one of the things that was bothering medicine was, are we a profession? What kind of educational requirements do we want to put in for doctors? How are we going to deal with our rivals who claim to be able to cure people but maybe use more testimonial and less evidence in terms of what they're doing? I don't think the specifics of the code are going to help work through today's problems, but the notion of using a code to answer a particular moral crisis, I think that still speaks very loudly and very materially to what's going on today.
Before we get back to the crisis in medicine today, let's look back at the crisis 150 years ago when the code was first written. Bob Baker, you've really been studying the history of the medical code. Why did doctors decide they needed a formal code 150 years ago?
If you looked at medicine in 1847, you'd see that every state that had previously licensed physicians had taken away their licenses because they viewed licensing as elitist. You'd see that every attempt to establish a scientific medicine in America had basically failed. You'd see that the only thing that you needed to practice medicine in America was an MD, and there were no requirements whatsoever for getting an MD, so that in effect, bad education, cheap education, short education, education without content was giving people the right to call themselves a doctor, and bad doctors were driving out good doctors.
Had the public lost faith in the doctors?
The public utterly had lost faith in qualified doctors, and the doctors needed some way to say, we are different because we're scientists, and you should choose us and not our competition. But even more than that, they needed some reason to think of themselves as being different. They needed some mechanism to get together and challenge their problems, because their problems were not only external, they were the inability of the medical community to agree on basic rudimentary ways of treating patients. There were no standards of care, basic medicine. There was no standard pharmacopoeia or a formula for making up drugs. The bare rudiments of medicine did not exist in America in 1847.
I'd like each of you to just pull out a couple of principles from the AMA's Code of Ethics, the code drafted 150 years ago, and tell us why you think these were very important principles for the medical profession. Art, you want to take it first?
Well, one of the driving values in the 1847 code, and startling in some ways because it's there, is the notion of selflessly treating the poor, that what you're called upon to do by this code, which if you look at it from 1997 perspective is just remarkable, is you're supposed to be willing to treat people without ability to pay. And you don't worry about that. Today, we go to the doctor, we go to the hospital. I think the first thing that happens is someone says, you got your insurance card and maybe a waiver after that to get in the emergency room or get in to see the doctor. 1847, the profession says, look, we are a profession, but what part of what our duty is here is to treat people regardless of their ability to pay. And if they're poor and we have to treat them for free, we ought to do that. Just a remarkable forswearing of kind of financial interest in favor of patient interest.
Name another.
Another part of the code, I don't know if it's a precept, I'll boil it down to a single value, is you're supposed to accept danger. These are people who are working in 1847. They got cholera. They got infectious diseases all over the place. the code calls upon them and it says, you have to take personal risk. If you're a doctor, if you're a physician, this is not the same as other professions. You've got to go out there and if you're going to get infected, you risk your life. You think about that in the world of AIDS, hepatitis, Ebola. A lot of doctors these days are thinking, well, I don't know. I'm not sure I'm really going to go out there and expose myself to an AIDS-infected patient as a surgeon. 1847, the notion is, if we're going to command society's respect, if we're going to get privilege, if we're going to have our due as a profession, we've got to show we're willing to bear personal risk.
Bob Baker, choose a couple of the principles from the code that you think have been very important.
My favorite actually is not in the code, but it was the principle that structured the code. Code was written by John Bell and Isaac Hayes. Bell wanted a basic principle underlying all American medical ethics, and the principle he chose was reciprocity. And the idea is, if we as a profession serve the public and our patients, they would reciprocate and respect us. Given that principle, in order to get their licenses back, in order to get public respect, they had to figure out how best to serve both the public, and Art just pointed out two of the most important ways in which they attempted to serve the public, and the individual patient. And it starts out with a statement that the physician will come when called. That is, they'll make house calls on anybody, and they'll do it irrespective of questions about payment. It then continues to say that we will treat our patients with attention, fidelity, humanity. An interesting notion, condescension, which may be understood, but it meant at the time that we would explain to our patients what we were doing to them and why. It also goes on to say that we will treat our patients tenderly, which is an interesting concept, and with delicacy, we'll keep their secrets. And it goes on for the first time ever in the history of any medical profession. It lays out a series of duties that the doctor has to a patient and therefore gives the patient a series of rights. So implicit in this document was a very rich list of patient rights that any patient who called on an AMA physician would have against those.
Now, Bob, you say after, about 50 years or so, a lot of doctors rebelled against the code of ethics. What was that rebellion about?
There is in these rebellions both a covert and an overt message. The official message is we want freedom to consult with whoever we want and to abide by our own standards of what's right and wrong. The freedom was to consult with homeopaths and alternative practitioners. That was the watchword. But underneath that is that doctors, especially specialists, could make extraordinary amounts of money by practicing their specialties, and they basically became restive with treating the poor patients in particular for free. The rebellion started in New York City, of course, which is the home of the specialist. It started in the 1880s, and in 1903, in New Orleans, it almost succeeded totally, and it did eviscerate the code by undercutting, by removing all enforcement provisions. There was a 10-year liberal hiatus in which medical ethics was no longer enforced in the United States, although the code existed in name. And in 1912, some parts of the force of the code were restored, but it never was the same tough, rich document that it was in 1847.
So the specialists broke away from the code and they had no ethics on paper guiding them?
That's correct. And the specialist societies they founded basically did not issue alternative or codes of ethics. And if you take a look, peeking up to the modern era in the era from 1950s to the 1970s, when there are a series of scandals that rock American medicine, they all came from the same two groups that broke from the AMA in 1903, and that is the specialist and the research scientist. And in both cases, they were interested in following specialty areas of interest, treating their patients as subjects. They sacrificed them in the name of science, and we had scandals like the scandal at Tuskegee at just down the corner from here, Jewish chronic disease and Jennings and Memorial Hospitals, and a series of others that rocked the country.
My guests are Robert Baker and Art Kaplan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, I have two guests. Bob Baker is a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania Center for Bioethics, and he teaches medical ethics at Union College in Schenectady. And Art Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and he organized a recent conference on the 150th anniversary of the AMA's Code of Ethics. I think one of the big crises for doctors now has to do with medical ethics versus business ethics, because many doctors are working for, you know, managed healthcare companies whose goal is to cut costs, keep costs low so that profit can be made. And there are incentives to do less testing, to give less care so that the care is cheaper. Art Kaplan, is there anything in the Medical Code of Ethics that can guide doctors through those tough decisions about medical versus business issues?
Well, I think that's really where we're at now, Terry. You've got business ethics looking like it's replacing medical ethics. And I think the number one complaint that doctors have is they feel that their advocacy, their ability to advocate for their patients, is being undercut by these outside constraints of money and management by non-medical people, MBAs replacing MDs, if you want to put it in simple terms. Patient worry is, gosh, how am I going to trust my doctor these days? Is he or she really going to do what's right for me, or am I going to get a drive-through delivery or a one-day mastectomy because these people are reporting to businessmen and stockholders who just don't care about quality of care? I think the code has to speak to this. My own view is both the AMA code, other codes of ethics are not doing it yet. They haven't touched base with that older tradition that said, if you want to be a profession and you want to hold the esteem of the American people and you want to be trusted, you must show yourself as willing to put personal interest, that's willingness to take risk in the old terms about getting sick or infected, and putting aside money interests to stand for your patient. I think they're inching that way a little bit, but the disease threat, the threat of cost and money all over the place, it requires a much more serious response than they're giving it yet. I think the bioethicists are yelling, come on, we've got to make sure that the one thing you can't have any doubt about is when you go to see the doctor, you better be sure that that doctor is for you first and foremost. I'm not sure they've met that challenge yet.
Well, now doctors are employees. I mean, doctors always had to answer to a hierarchy at the hospital, but the hospital was run by medical people too. But now they're working for HMOs and they're employees in a way of business interests. And so who's there to support the doctor if the doctor idealistically calls on a principal and says, I cannot compromise my code as a doctor and I cannot do this? Well, then he gets bounced or something. I mean, what's there to protect him?
Nothing. And in fact, we just went through a round of this. We heard about last year, all the rage was a discussion of gag rules. The doctors can't tell you this, doctors can't tell you that. How medicine could put itself in a position where we'd put up with any of this? I mean, being told that you can't discuss options or alternatives or give full information is absolutely morally out of the question. It seems to me organized medicine was so on the run, so beaten down, so pummeled by this drive from business and third-party payers and government to get those costs down that they abandoned ship. They basically bailed out and said, okay, we're just employees. They've got to put together their organizational clout. And secondly, they've got to look for allies in new places. I think they can't do it alone. They've got to join up with those patients again. They've got to be seen as the patient's ally and be trying to muster political support to say, look, it's not just our interest. It's not my salary that's being cut that leads me to want to challenge the HMO. It's because your quality of care is going down or I can't talk to you freely. You've got to stand with me, patient, so we can take on this juggernaut together.
I understand that some doctors are joining unions so that they have some clout when it, not only in terms of money, but when they want to make a decision that they can considered ethical and their HMO is urging them in the other direction. Do you see this as a trend that's going to keep growing? Bob, do you have any thoughts on that?
It's ironic because a profession, by definition, is you control your own agenda and therefore you're not an employee or a laborer. I think myself, to define yourself as a laborer and to form yourself into a union is to begin to accept that other people set the agenda, and it's already to begin to concede defeat. I don't see that as the first or the optimal strategy for the profession. I think, as and I'm in total agreement with Art, the profession should take the high ground. It has to redefine its interest in terms of its patient's interest, in terms of the public's interest, and it should do such things as, one, very simple idea, and I think the AMA is actually working on this, have a report card, a checklist that patients can use to see whether or not their HMO, their IPA, their managed care organization is giving them the sorts of things that in the AMA's view it thinks ought to be given. Have 800 numbers that the physicians working for managed care can call to get to the AMA if, in fact, they have GAV rules, if, in fact, they feel that their rights as physicians to protect the public and their patients are being infringed. I think that it's clear that American medicine ought to organize. It ought to organize around medical values, around serving the patient. And it ought to do that in a variety of ways that are powerful, but need not allow that the management has the right to shape the agenda. And I think if you form a union, you've basically given management that right, at least in America.
I just add one other point. I think unionization is a disaster. The power of unionization is to withhold services. It's to strike. I can't imagine medicine as a field being one of those areas where you withhold your services if you don't get what you want. So I think going that road without the major power in your hands of being able to go on strike or withhold services, which I don't think the American people would put up with for long, is a disaster for medicine. The other reason I think unionization is not the road to go, although I understand full well why many doctors think it's the road they better travel, is it accepts the terms of the debate. It just says, okay, it is money, and we're going to fight for our interests relative to those managers and cost containers who are crushing down our interests. But unions don't necessarily speak up for the public interest. They speak up for the employees' interests, and I don't think that's where medicine wants to be. It needs that trust as part of that doctor-patient relationship, and I'm not sure unionization is going to be the way to cement that.
What do you think doctors and patients need to do to ensure that there are still medical ethics?
Out there somewhere? Well, I think a couple of things have to happen. First, organized medicine has to say, all right, you can take us seriously. We do want to work with you. We will be willing to make some concessions in terms of where we need to go with American healthcare. If it is, in fact, inevitable that we've got to get our costs contained, then let's do it in a public and accountable way. One of the things that terrifies me these days about how cost containment is proceeding in America is going on behind closed doors. It happens at stockholders' meetings and in boardroom meetings. The profession has to jump up and say, look, we want these decisions made. We want them made on medical grounds, not according to what's cheapest or what is appeals to the CEO of a particular organization. So they have to press with patients for publicity and accountability, openness about how decisions are going to be made. I think the second thing that profession has to do with patients is basically say, look, we're going to protect your privacy. We are losing privacy. It's like people talk about the loss of the rainforest at, you know, whatever it is, 1,000 acres a day. Privacy is eroding all around us. We go into the hospital, we wave it off, and 100 people can see our records. Who knows how many bureaucrats are looking at our personal and private medical records at insurance companies. Medicine has to get in and say, nope, we're going to restore that to you. It's essential to your dignity. It's essential to your self-worth. We're going to fight to get that back. And the last recommendation I would make about physician-patient alliances is I think that medicine has to stand up and say, look, we will never be gagged. You can always depend on us to tell you the truth. Even if you can't get what we're telling you you might need, we will tell you so that you can raise a stink about it. It just doesn't cohere with trust in medicine to have people believe that they're not getting the full story from the doctor. So they have to swear that no matter what goes on, they'll never accept management forms that gag or restrict or in any way limit communication. That's just not compatible with good medical ethics.
My guests are Art Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, and Robert Baker, a visiting scholar at the center. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with bioethicist Art Kaplan and Professor Robert Baker, who teaches the history of medical ethics. They recently helped organize a conference on the AMA's Code of Ethics. Bob, I want to ask you another question about where we are now compared to where we were 150 years ago when the AMA adopted the Medical Code of Ethics. One of the issues 150 years ago is what does it take to be a real doctor as opposed to just somebody posing as a doctor who wasn't really qualified? And what was the difference between a real certified medical doctor and somebody who knew some unconventional stuff and claimed to be able to heal you, but they weren't really a doctor? Some parallel today is the rift between medical doctors and people practicing non-conventional therapies or alternative therapies that are actually quite traditional in other parts of the world, but not in the United States, like acupuncture, or more modern versions of that, various herbal remedies, homeopathy. And what response do you see doctors having, and what response What do you think they could learn historically about how to deal with alternatives?
Well, one thing we know is since one of the objectives in 1847 was to respond successfully to these challenges by convincing the public that regular conventional medicine works, since that succeeded in 1847, you have to follow the same, you should follow the same strategy in 1997. If people go to alternative medicine, it's not, for some, it's clearly a lifestyle choice. I mean, they don't like living conventionally and they don't like going to conventional doctors, and that's fine. For others, it's because they have lost faith in what conventional medicine has to offer. And the way in which you reassert that faith is not to bludgeon people over the head, but to show people what you have to offer and to do it well.
One interesting tension, and I don't have an answer for this, and I don't know how what modern medicine can do about this. When people seek out alternative healers today, I do think part of the answer is for American medicine to step up to the plate and say, no, our conventional interventions are better. We can get better results. The other reason people go there, though, is they're looking for somebody to talk to them. They want some personal interaction. They don't want people who come and spend 15 seconds at the bedside or have nothing to say when someone finds out they've got breast cancer or dying. For a long time, we've been yelling within bioethics about improving communication and spending more time talking with patients and that this aspect of illness has to be addressed too. I'm a little bit in despair about whether this is going to be possible in the sort of technological medicine that we've got. I used to think, well, if we could just yell loud enough, what the AMA and organized medicine could do is call for change in medical education and continuing education. But when you look at managed care today, with its 15 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes per patient, you see in the high-tech areas where people are very sick, people trying to master all this machinery and teams of people running around, it may be that one of the things that medicine has to do is specialize the communication side so that it is captured, but maybe not something that everyone is expected to do. Otherwise, I think people will continue to go on to the alternative sides, not just for cure, but also for conversation, just for basic interpersonal interaction when they don't feel well, or they're sick, or they're desperate. And I'm not sure medicine has figured out what the answer to that's going to be. It has a lot of constraints that make it tough to do that kind of work within mainstream medicine.
Can I put a word in for alternative medicine? I mean, there always ought to be alternative medicine. It would be a mistake for there not to be. It's, as Paul Wolpe, who's also at the center, points out, an incubator for new ideas. It's a place for people who feel uncomfortable with the conventions. It's a mode of not scientific experimentation, but human-style experimentation, lifestyle experimentation. And sometimes, rarely, it gives you scientific breakthroughs. But by and large, it's with the modes of delivery and human interaction that alternative medicine serves a real and important alternative to the conventional practice.
Is there anything you see happening now in medical education that you're optimistic about?
Yes. I think that a couple of things have happened. One, there are now required courses on medical ethics for all medical students at a lot of medical schools. I think also students are finding it very common to be able to talk about some of these health policy issues, learn a little health economics, get a handle on what this health maintenance organization, managed care phenomenon is all about. And in the continuing medical education arena, I think people are starting to realize, well, we can introduce discussions as we develop and evolve as doctors, nurses, healthcare providers that open up some of these ethics questions and cases too. It doesn't have to all be technical training. We can do ethics training. So I think some of that has started to shift and that's been for the good. We need a lot more, but I think there are areas where that's changing and changing for the better.
Bob Baker?
Also, the MBA side of the equation should not be neglected. One of the things I do, and I know a lot of bioethicists are beginning to do, is teach medical ethics to the people getting MBAs in healthcare to make sure that the next generation of HMO managers are ethically sensitive and know something about the traditions of medical ethics.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us about medical ethics and medical code. Thank you both.
My pleasure.
Pleasure.
Art Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Robert Baker is a visiting scholar at the center and a professor at Union College in Schenectady.